So turn back, if you would, to Daniel chapter 11. Been looking at the book of Daniel over the summer and made our way through some very strange prophecies and visions and things like that. But here's a difficult one, perhaps. You might have thought that in just reading it through. We only read half the chapter. It's just packed. It's a really long chapter, for starters. And it's just packed full of information and so on. So it's quite a lot to sort of chew on. But this is the food God gives us from his word. The elderly prophet Daniel is now probably in his 70s or 80s. And it's quite late on in his life. We're told at the beginning of chapter 10, this is now the third year of King Cyrus. That means the exiles have gone home, or some of them at least. So 70 years of exile has come to an end. But Daniel's probably likely to be a bit too old to make that kind of journey, so he stays on. And he hears this vision. And we're told there in verse 1 of chapter 10, the message was true. But the appointed time was long. So he's given this true message, but it's a message that will take a long time to be fulfilled. Prophecy that was about hundreds and hundreds of years. And we'll look at a bit of some of those today. And he's given this true message, as we said. And in it, he's told what will happen over the course of the years ahead. It starts in the first couple of verses with quite a rapid account. Verse 2, I'll tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth will be richer than them all. So there'll be three more kings of Persia, then a fourth. The last will be the greatest, far richer than all. By his strength and through riches, he'll stir up all against the realm of Greece. His name was Xerxes. He's probably the same king as we have in the book of Esther, and a little bit later through the Bible. And he's this king of Persia. He's the greatest one. And if you can vaguely see the map, Persia occupied a huge bit there of just into Europe and just into Africa. And this huge swathe across Asia as well. And that was the Persian Empire. This last king was the greatest of all of those. And he stirred up all against the realm of Greece. But he loses. So he ends up heading westwards towards the land of Greece over here. But he loses, even though he's this great king. You might know this, the only bit people might have a bit of awareness from their school geography and things like that, or history. There was the famous Battle of Salamis, where the Persians fought against the Greeks at a naval battle of the ancient world. And there was also the Battle of Thermopylae, which was, again, quite well known because of the 300 Spartans who held the pass. Both of those events have been made into films in the not too recent past. But that's probably about where most of our general knowledge really is fading out, if it got that far. After him came the Empire of Greece, which was a very similar bit of land. Obviously a bit more of Greece. That's where it started. And with Alexander the Great, it all went all the way over to the borders of India as well. That's what's referred to in verse 3. Then a mighty king shall arise, who will rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And the thing we see in this whole chapter is this phrase we're going to keep using, and it came true. These things were told to Daniel, and then they came true. These events of verses 2 and 3 happened about 50 years later, about 50 years or so, after the time of Daniel, these things started to happen. And the Greek Empire then came to the fore. In the end, it was broken up, verse 4, into four sections. Get me to say, and it came true, just as God prophesied. Now, some of those bits we've done before, so we don't need to do that in great detail. Lots of those things were in some of the other visions. The vision of the statue, the vision of the beasts, and the ram and the goat and things like that that we've looked at in previous chapters. The bulk of the chapter, then, is about the wars between, as it's given in our title, between the king of the north and the king of the south. And that's what mostly is going on then through the rest of the chapter. We're looking at about half of it today. Of course, that was of interest to Daniel and to the people of Israel because they lived in the middle. So there's these two kingdoms that feature mostly in this passage. It's not the only thing going on in the world, of course, but it's the thing that's of most interest to the people of Israel. So in the south, there was a kingdom down there towards Egypt that was ruled by its first king Ptolemy with silent P. And so that's why that's one kingdom. And then the other kingdom was up here in the north. They were known as the Seleucids. And Israel was there in the middle. And so that's what's going on in this chapter. It's a bit of a bizarre chapter in some ways. We might feel sometimes we're sort of wading through it. But what I want to just briefly do as we just work through the verses is keep coming back to that phrase, and it came true. These things were told by Daniel years and years before they happened. So in verse 5, he's told about the king of the south. That was this king called Seleucid. And we're told that one of his princes became strong too and gained power and had dominion. And it came true. Just as Daniel prophesied, one of his princes ended up becoming a rival. And he was the one who set up this northern kingdom then and made his own kingdom. And that's how these wars sort of developed. There were two sort of bits of what was left of the Greek Empire. And these wars began to happen afterwards. And so we're told in verse 6 that they try to join forces. And the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. So there's an attempt at a diplomatic marriage to unite these two warring kingdoms, as was quite common in those days. But it all fails. It's about the year 250 BC by now. And it's attempted, but it ends in disaster. Most of them get murdered. It's a pretty grisly story. And in verse 7 we're told, but from a branch of her roots, so this bride who dies, one of her brothers rises up, and he then comes with a great army from the south against the fortress of the king of the north. And he deals with them and prevails, and he carries the gods and their treasures back to Egypt. Verse 8. And it came true. Just as Daniel recorded, about 250 years later, maybe nearly 300 years later, it all came true, just as God said. And so you have these two rivals then going on, and one thing just pausing, just in application, right here fairly early on, is Jesus told us, didn't he? There'll be wars and rumours of wars in the times up to the end. And we see that's the case long before Jesus says those words. It's there in the Old Testament, isn't it? And here it's prophesied to Daniel. What's going to happen when the Old Testament comes to an end and before the New Testament quite begins? What's going to happen in those middle years? There's going to be wars and rumours of wars. And this chapter is full of it. This chapter, that's all it's about. These wars between the north and south. And perhaps one thing that comes across in it is the sheer futility of it. You're just going to and fro. The south attacks the north attacks the south. One has a victory, one has a defeat. Different things happen, one after the other. It's utterly futile. Perhaps, as Solomon would say, a chasing after the wind. And they fight, and people die. And the conflict then just passes on to their children. Did you see that? One person dies, and so an offshoot from her roots. One of her brothers rises up to carry on the fight. It carries on in later verses. Verse 9, the king of the north will come to the king of the south, but will return. However, his sons will stir up the strife. And on it goes. One generation after another, fighting. And in this chapter, you probably have 200-300 years of history. And the border kept getting moved through Israel. Israel keeps being controlled by one group and then by the opposite group. And the border just keeps switching through it. And at the end of 200, 300 years, the border is still in roughly the same place it was to start with. It is almost utterly futile that it doesn't achieve anything. Fighting for one little patch of land, one retaliation after another. And again, some words of Jesus. What profits it a man if he gains the whole world and yet loses his soul? And yet here in this chapter we see these kings certainly attempting just that. To gain the whole world, or at least to gain mastery of another bit of land. But what does it gain them? What benefit does it bring? Just hundreds of years of bloodshed. And so we see the same going on today, don't we? The futile wars of humankind that are sadly so predictable and are passed on from one generation to another to continue the fight that seems so utterly pointless. Another thing we see in the chapter is the plans of men seem so certain, but they never are. If you want to, you can look through this chapter and try and notice the word "but" that keeps coming up. We had one already, this idea, you know, they make this diplomatic marriage. The king of the south sends his daughter to the king of the north, but she doesn't retain the power of her authority. It sounds like a great idea, but it fails and ends in disaster. And so we'll see it in the later verses. One king comes against the other with a huge army, but he doesn't win. Some things seem so certain to mankind, but the plans of men are never certain. And so right at the start, as we sort of work through a few more of these verses in a moment, we'll see those same kind of things. And we're meant to kind of groan a little bit in a chapter like this, just to think about the depravity of mankind. All this bloodshed, all this fighting. And 2,000 years have gone past since these days, and we're just the same. And we look at the news with the same despair and think, what a mess. The situations we see that are so predictable, that carry on and on. So on carries this strange story, this prophecy that keeps coming true, as we will see, and the wars continue. You have these kings of the south and the king of the north. Lots of the ones in the south are called Ptolemy. By the time we get to verse 11 or so, verse 10, 11, where we are now, we've got Ptolemy the fourth, who's in control in the south, Antiochus the third, who's king of the north, and they're fighting again. And this war is repeated then by his sons, verse 10. One of his sons, that's the chap, Antiochus the third, comes with a great army, and he goes and fights and assembles a great multitude of forces, verse 10, and then he overwhelms and passes, and he fails, verse 9, in the first instance, he returns to his own land. And then, verse 11, the king of the south will be moved with rage and go and fight him. The king of the north will come with a great multitude, but it'll be given into his hand of his enemy. And then for the king of the south, he'll cast down tens of thousands, verse 12. But then he loses anyway. And the king of the north comes back with an even greater army than he had in the first place, and much equipment, and he finally wins that bit, at least, of the battle. In verse 14, very strange little phrase, it seems that violent men of your people, is this talking to Daniel, is this talking about some of the Israelites who get involved? But anyway, we're told about them, they're violent men who exalt themselves. So they're obviously not really God's people, are they? Whoever side they think they're fighting for. And the battles carry on. The king of the north, verse 15, will come and build a siege mound. And it all came true. These kings, by now the king of the south has changed, it's Ptolemy the fifth, if you wanted to know. Maybe the north is on a winning streak at this time. That's probably because Ptolemy's only a child, and so maybe he's not the greatest of leaders. He's thought to only be about 10 or so at this point. And in the north there's a winning streak, and he comes and builds this great siege mound and takes a fortified city. And it came true. And that was the Battle of Sidon in the year 198 BC. Just as God said, all of these things happened. The forces of the south don't withstand him. Even his choice troops can't resist. So the south is really beaten far back at this point. And this Tychicus the Third. He calls himself the Great, as they all do. He's the one who's in control at this time. And he's the one who enters the glorious land, that's the land of Israel, now firmly under northern control, verse 16. And so he is. We're told in verse 17, he then tries to control the whole lot. And so he gives his daughter to marry this child king in the south. And he hopes that by doing that, he's going to control both kingdoms, verse 17. And then it fails. His daughter sides with her new husband against her father. And so things carry on. Don't worry, nearly getting towards the end of these verses now. But it keeps happening. All of these things that were prophesied keep coming true, just as God has said. We're on to verse 18. And we're told after this, this king, Tychicus the Third, will turn his face to the coastlands and take many. And it came true. Rather getting bored of wars with Egypt, he decided to start a new war with some of the Mediterranean islands. And he won. And then, we're told halfway through, but a ruler shall bring reproach against him. That's the Romans. They weren't best pleased on someone coming in on their turf. He's forced to retreat. Tychicus then turns his back towards the fortress of his own land and stumbles and falls on the way, verse 19. And it happens. On his way retreating back home, he's murdered by some people he invaded before. And so that's the end of him. His son, then the next bit, verse 20, in his place, one who arises is his son. He was known as Seleucus the Fourth. And he has to raise taxes, just as it says in verse 20. He imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom. Because of the trouble with Rome, he has to pay a lot of tax to pay them off. And so he raids the temple and taxes the glorious land, as we've got in verse 20. And this only happens for a couple of days before, just as it is prophesied, he's destroyed, not in anger nor in battle. He's killed by his own prime minister. And then on you go. And in the next verse, verse 21, rises up another character. We have dealt with him before, but that's more than enough for today. We'll look at that in another time. And so here we have maybe a little bit of a baffling chapter. Let's be honest. Our knowledge of the ancient world and its battles is really unfamiliar stuff to all of us, isn't it? Maybe we might remember the tiniest bit of these kind of things, maybe from school, but probably not. Now, this is ancient history with people with unpronounceable names and battles that happened 2,000 years ago. And so it might be a chapter that we look through and think, oh, this is hard work this morning. And I don't really see much of the wood for the trees or what the whole point of this is this morning. So I'm going to make a bold statement. I think this chapter is one of the best chapters in the Bible to help our faith. It's a bit of a bold claim to make. You might not have thought that, wading through some of those verses. But this really is a faith-building chapter. Jesus said in John 17, verse 17, when he was talking to another ruler, "Your word is truth." Your word is truth. When Jesus was talking with Pilate, he talked about the need for truth, a Roman leader who came far later on. And we were thinking, and we're going to read a little bit this evening in Titus, and it has this phrase in Titus of God who cannot lie. Your word is truth. Not just your word is true, says Jesus. That is correct. But your word is truth. Everything about it, it is really true truth. It is the most truthful truth there is. With a few tongue twisters like that. And so this chapter is full of truth. We're giving it the title, "And It Came True." Every single verse. God tells Daniel what is going to happen in 50 years, 100 years, 200 years, 300 years' time. That's where this chapter's going. And all of it comes true. Daniel, of course, is looking forward all these years, these centuries that lie ahead of him that he won't see. We look back at these same things. And every single verse in this chapter happens. And if you wanted to take the time, you could work through every verse in this chapter, and find archaeological and historical evidence of it actually happening. You could find the name of the king, who it's really talking about. These are all references to the king of the north and the king of the south, but you can find their real name. You could find other people who are involved, different generals, different diplomats, and so on. Some of these wives who are given in marriage, they've all got names, they're all written down. The people of the Ptolemites and the Seleucids did keep quite accurate records. Lots of them are still in our museums. So you can look through and find a date, a king, a location for your battle. Everything that happens in this chapter, everything that's prophesied, comes exactly true. So if you wanted to spend a long time, it'd probably be the kind of thing you'd write a PhD on, you could work through this chapter and see every single bit of it happens. And that should help us to trust God. Here God spells out to Daniel what's going to happen through 300 years that lies in the future to him. And we can look back and see it as history, that it all did happen exactly as God had said. So, if in this chapter every sentence comes true, that should give us great trust in the Lord, shouldn't it? For all God's prophecies that have not yet come true, because they definitely will too. All of these prophecies to Daniel were fulfilled. And so all of those things that are in God's word, we can hold to with the same confidence. Here we have a chapter of prophecy fulfilled. And that then should stir our faith for all the things that lie ahead as well. So this chapter should help build our faith as we see all of these things coming true. A second thing, this chapter should help our faith because it helps us understand the world. God is still God, even when he's never mentioned. Again, it's a bit of a strange chapter. So it's introduced in chapter 10, but then in the whole of chapter 11, God's not mentioned. None of these kings ever mention the King of Kings. But he's still God. He still is the King of Kings, even if he doesn't appear exactly like that in the pages we're reading. God is still God, even when he's not mentioned. So in this chapter, we see the reigns of all these warring kings. And the King of Kings is never mentioned, but he still reigns. And that should help us in our faith. To see sometimes there can be two things going on. This chapter tells us about all the things that are happening there, as it were, on the surface of planet Earth. All these armies that are crisscrossing the land of Israel. These kings, these diplomats, these taxes, all these different things that are happening. We're just looking on one plane, one surface. But we know overall the King of Kings reigns. Because here in this chapter, he's the one who spelt it all out. He's the one who reveals himself to Daniel back in chapter 10. That's why we read those verses. He's the one who stands with eyes like fire, glowing white like lightning, and a voice like the voice of a multitude. He stands, the glorious king, over it all. Even if no one mentions him for a while, he still is reigning there. And for us today, that's the same case, isn't it? We hear of wars. We see on our news armies of Russia and the Ukraine and Hamas and Israel. We see all these things. All these kings, all these prime ministers, all these presidents. No one mentions the King of Kings on the news, do they? But we know. We know from this chapter and how you can extrapolate it forwards that he still reigns now. Even when everything seems a complete mess to us watching the news, we know God knows what's going on. He's the one who reigns. Another way this chapter can help our faith is, as we were suggesting already, that there can be things happening under the radar that never get mentioned. The kings of the north and south are the ones that get all these mentions here, all the headlines. And the people of God aren't mentioned once. But they're still there. And Christ is building his kingdom. And so, again, we need to see through this chapter something that will give us then help in the world we face today. Again, in the news we read, we read of the kingdoms of the north and south, or whatever they're called these days. That's what's on the BBC. But we know, and this chapter can help us have that faith, to know that the kingdom of Christ is growing. Under the radar, it's not going to be reported on the BBC, but Jesus is building his kingdom. That's what's going on. One last thing. As we work through this chapter, this ancient history that maybe doesn't mean an awful lot to us, the fourth thing that's happening is Christmas is coming. When you think about it, in this chapter, that's what's happening. Christmas is coming. In Matthew chapter 1, we're given something of the genealogy, aren't we? Of what's going on. And as we said at the beginning, this all happens and God's people have returned from exile. Daniel, who's staying there, the year is 536 BC or so. And he looks forward 250 years. That's what we've roughly done this morning. And yet we know something else. There's only about another 250 years to go from where we've got to in this chapter. Matthew in his gospel lists us some of the names. And in Matthew chapter 1, we're told of this family line of Zerubbabel, and then Abiad, then Eliazim, then Azor's born, then Zadok, then Akim, Eliad, Eleazar, Mathan, Jacob, Joseph, and Jesus. Zerubbabel is mentioned because he's the one who returns from exile. And so what's happening all these years? People are being born. The family line of David is carrying on. It's all under the radar. It's all very quiet. But we've made our way through 250 years of history. We're probably one of these middle characters now. And they're being born and they're having children. Wars come and go. Battles are fought. These kingdoms are made and these kingdoms fall. There's kings, there's diplomacy, there's treason, there's revolts. But one thing we need to remember, God's plan of salvation is right on track. Christmas is coming. Through all of these things that are happening, God is putting everything in place for the sending of his son. And it's bang on track. Nothing can go wrong. In all the uncertainties that we see, it's certain to God. Christmas is coming. He's going to send his son. We, of course, can look back. But with the same confidence, knowing that God's plan is right on track. When we're afraid, when we think the world seems in absolute chaos, may a chapter like this help us in our faith to see that the King of Kings is the one who reigns.